And speaking of the programming, one of the people that we've been very fortunate to have included in this program is Juan Palomo, who is a writer and an editor with the Houston Post. And many of you might be familiar with Juan's story about how he came out when he wrote about the murder of Paul Borchardt and the impact that that had on his life. And he continues to be a voice for our community. He recently interviewed writer Michael Corey and the composer Stuart Wallace, who are the people behind the Houston Grand Opera's production of Harvey Milk. It's going to be premiering tomorrow, and we have this interview for you now, and we will be giving you some more information about this outstanding event that's happening right here in Houston at the Wortham Center. So stay tuned to listen to Lesbian and Gay Voices as we hear this interview with Juan Palomo.
This is Juan Palomo for Lesbian and Gay Voices. Our guests today are Michael Corey and Stuart Wallace, who are in town for rehearsals of the Houston Grand Opera production of Harvey Milk, a new opera based on the life and death of the history-making gay San Francisco supervisor who was shot to death by a fellow supervisor in 1978. Harvey Milk will have its world premiere on January 21st at the Wortham Center, and will have five more performances here before it goes on to New York and later San Francisco. The premiere will be preceded by a benefit preview performance on January 19th to benefit the Barron Service Center and the many services it offers people with AIDS. Michael Corey is 39 years old and is a native of New Jersey. His first career was as a journalist, including a stint with the Village Voice. He has been collaborating with Stuart Wallace for about 10 years, and together they have produced three operas, Where's Dick, Kabbalah, and Hopper's Wife. He lives in New York with his lover of 18 years, Ivan Sagoda. Okay, Stuart Wallace is 34, and he grew up in Houston. He first gained the attention of Houston Grand Opera General Director David Gockley a number of years ago when he submitted a short piece called Soap to an HGR program that was attempting to find new young composers. Wallace does not come from an academic and symphonic background, but is instead rooted more in pop music. Gockley likes to compare him to Leonard Bernstein, who he says was able to wed serious music and the music of the Americas. He and his partner, Mary Ellen Carroll, also live in New York. I'd like to welcome both of you and thank you for taking the time to be here with us. Harvey Milk, Harvey Milk in Houston just does not seem to make sense to a lot of people. Here's a very controversial, almost radical gay politician, and here is Houston, Texas, still very conservative. Can either of you tell us what's going on here? Why this is happening?
Why it's happening and how it's happening are two very different things. But as far as it being done in Houston, Harvey Milk is a hero. And there are very few and far between. And the fact that he was a hero of the gay and lesbian community is of great interest nationally, internationally, to everybody. Our first piece was called Where's Dick? And that was about the search for American heroes, and it was a fruitless search. It ended up with a rather cynical viewpoint that America didn't have any heroes anymore. And here, 5 years later, in Harvey Milk, this radical street activist turned politician, we have found a hero that speaks to gays and lesbians, and I hope everybody.
The idea was first suggested by a director from Germany who David Gockley was very interested in working with. He had seen the documentary on Harvey Milk's life on German television and was very moved by him both personally and by his mission. And he wanted to do a new opera based on Harvey Milk's life. David then sent him a tape of our first work together, Where's Dick? And the piece ensued from there. Now, what's happened over the course of time is, of course, we have a different director here now, the director who we've worked with on the piece, and it's a very different Harvey Milk than I think perhaps any of them intended. We decided that we wanted to know what made Harvey Milk tick. What was the thing that made this rather ordinary guy from Jewish family in Long Island, who was at one time living as a closeted Wall Street stockbroker, go off and become a civil rights leader? And so that was our search in defining the opera. The opera was not about Harvey Milk getting killed. We wanted an opera about his life and his legacy, and I think that's what we've done.
Okay. Most of the people who listen to this show don't know very much about the opera. I mean, there's a lot of people who love the opera, but most of them, like me, have no idea how something like this comes about and progresses. I mean, we have somebody producing the music, another person producing the words. Can you enlighten us a little bit as to how these are meshed together? What is the process here? Who goes first? I mean.
Well, actually, the thing that comes first is no writing at all. It's a lot of talking. Michael and I have developed a way of working over a long period of time now. And we sit down and we talk and we research. Michael went to San Francisco, did interviews with many of the principal people who were involved in Harvey Milk's campaign and who knew him. And then we talk about the ideas, what we want to convey, and structure and form. So before anything is actually written, there's a lot of discussion about shape and distillation and how we're going to make this. Then what generally happens is Michael goes away and writes for a long time. And after that, we have a series of meetings where we discuss it, we edit it, we shape it, and this takes a rather long time. And so I generally try not to write a note of music until we have what would be a very strong first draft. And from there, then I can see the whole shape of the piece, where the themes reoccur. It gives me a sense of the skeleton of the whole opera, and that's when I like to begin composing.
And after that, is it just a matter of give and take? I mean,
there's a lot of
accommodate each other.
A lot, yes. Stewart needs at least one complete act before he can begin composing, because he needs to see the musical arc of the piece, where it's going to be going. You need to know the ending before you can know how you're going to get there in opera. But we approach all our pieces very organically, very spontaneously. We don't have a set of rules for people who aren't familiar with the opera, some of your listeners.
I mean, I've been sort of researching this opera for a few months now, and I've sat in on some of the rehearsals. Most people think of opera as something that is sung in some foreign language, either Italian or French or German or whatever, and therefore the image that most people have is, you know, the words don't matter, it's the music that's supposed to provide enough passion and everything else. Yet here we have an opera in English.
The words matter.
That was what I was going to get at. I was listening to, watching the rehearsal the other day, and the director told the chorus, you know, the words matter as much as the music here, or if not more. If I'm not mistaken, going through, they're even going to have surtitles here to make sure that people get the words here. I mean, why? I mean, I guess most everybody who has ever written an opera says the words matter, but tell us why they're.
Well,
they're,
I have mixed emotions about the surtitles, because I think when you read, you don't hear music, and really the art form is a wedding of music and language and image. And so I think, and sometimes those things get in the way, but comprehensibility is very, very important to us. There's one thing that I want to say in relation that sort of ties these two things together about why an opera like this would be interesting for contemporary people, when opera seems like an archaic and removed from an archaic form that's removed from American culture. I think that what has fueled our collaboration has been an engagement in the political issues of our day in one form or another. And I think that has been a consistent thing. So the issues that turn us on are issues that are important, and they're important now. They're not about Greek mythology. They're not about Italian history. They're really about American ideals and American problems. And so somebody coming to an opera like this would be able to recognize themselves in the opera.
Mm. But, you know, this sort of leads to another question. You know, Michael and I were talking about this the other day, and a lot of the gay opera audience are people who like the old stuff. I mean, and they don't want to be bothered with anything new, especially something that's controversial. And yet you're sort of, I mean, aren't you sort of dragging them into the modern world here and asking them to look at opera in a new way?
Yeah, in some ways we've even commented on them a bit. In that Harvey Milk, as a young boy, first gets introduced to his identity at the opera, where he views all these opera fans, these men who come to the opera and stand in the back of the opera in the standing room section who doesn't know what they are. Men in Woodmere, Long Island, bowl in a bowling league. And who are these men that know these fancy Italian phrases and names of dead divas? He calls them the men without wives. And the back of the opera house was kind of a metaphor to us for the back of the bus. Where gay men were
rather
in
plush
the 40s.
Bus.
A plush bus. To some degree, there is a certain generation of gay men that continue to go to the opera, that consider it their own special world, and they resent the fact that we're dragging what they perceive as a political agenda into the opera house. I, in fact, don't think we are dragging in a political agenda. I don't feel the piece is a polemic. I feel that we do use the eras of gay life in America, but we do a take on each of them. So, I mean, I've heard some comments that I've been rather surprised at about that old-fashioned point of view. What do we need to see this for? I don't have friends that are drag queens. I don't have friends that run around in leather. Why do we have to look at this in the opera house when we could be seeing Rigoletto?
Well, Harvey Milk's point of view, really, I mean, oddly enough, or maybe not so oddly, the people who supported Harvey Milk first were the drag queens. And that's because he said that it's a big tent. Gay life is a big tent, as life at large. I mean, his basic principles were that inclusion was important. And that meant everybody, regardless of how they behaved, how they looked, what they did, it was important to bring everyone in. And I think Harvey Milk, when he goes back as a 39-year-old man in our opera, and he goes back to the opera and he sees the same men and they're saying the same things, he feels that nothing has changed and it's important, it's a time to make a change. And he breaks that mold, and that's when he leaves his closeted Wall Street life and becomes a street activist.
Ultimately, he returns to the opera the night before his death.
Which is in fact true.
He
was
true.
At Tosca the night before.
Having a death premonition the night before at Tosca. And this time he sees the men and women at the opera, the gay men and women couples, now open in the front of the opera, openly cheering their own elected supervisor. So the opera becomes sort of a means for Milk to measure his progress in the world.
Mm. Tell us a little bit more about Harvey Milk and what opera meant to him. I mean, he wasn't just somebody who went to the opera every once in a while. I mean, you have a very special scene in there, in which his lover sort of he's cutting his hair while they're listening to.
That was one of the things I found out on my interviews. I really wasn't satisfied with the existing sources on Harvey Milk in terms of really coming to know the man in a personal way, and I did all these interviews, and one of them was with his lover, who still survives in San Francisco, Scott Smith. And I had heard that Harvey Milk was an opera fan. In fact, I found out from someone at the San Francisco Opera that one of the perks that he got as an elected official were free seats to the opera, and nothing could thrill him more. And I loved that contradiction of this street activist with a ponytail who loved the opera. And I don't really think it's that unusual when you think that in the 40s, when Harvey Milk was first learning to discover himself, the opera was one of the few places where gay men could be gay. Opera is such a strange, unique world with its own set of rules that it can't make very many judgments. And he felt comfortable there, as a lot of men of his generation did. He continued to love opera through his life. It was almost a secret love. And I spoke with this lover and I said, what did he like? He says, well, he didn't run crazy about Italian opera, but he did like La Boheme. But oddly enough, the thing that he liked most was German opera, Wagner. And they would sit in bed and listen to opera, and Harvey would sing along. And you know, there was a very theatrical side to his nature that really he knew how to use and was aware of. When he moved out to San Francisco, he was perceived as an interloper by the existing power structure there, the gays and Jews. And they were much more assimilated already in California. And here he came, this loudmouthed pastrami sandwich-eating Jew with an agenda from New York, waving his flyers, standing on his soapbox, leafleting, and they disliked him intensely. But he knew how to use his cultural identity, his ethnicity, his purpose, I think that there was an incident described in the book by Randy Schultz, the mayor of Castro Street, where upon being elected to City Hall, he went into that wonderful grand rotunda with a friend and motioned his hand out and said, "How do you like my new theater?" And this was a side of Harvey Milk we were drawn to, wanted to explore, and we liked the idea that in the opera of Harvey Milk, the opera itself would serve as a metaphor.
We're listening to an interview conducted by Juan Palomo. He's interviewing Michael Corre and the writer and the composer Stuart Wallace of the Harvey Milk Opera, which is opening tomorrow night at the Wortham Center, 7:30 p.m., and it's going to play for only 8 performances. We are very lucky that Juan was able to do this interview, and I think I've learned more about the opera listening to this interview than I've read in some of the magazines and all the other things that we were able to get a hold of. Some very interesting points he talked about, including Harvey's love for the opera, and how there was men sitting in the back of the opera who were gay men or men without wives. Very interesting stuff, and we're very lucky that this opera's coming to Houston. We're also very lucky that Juan was able to do this interview. And if you appreciate this type of programming here on KPFT, we're asking you to call 526-5738, 526-KPFT. There's premiums that we will give you when you make your pledges. Our suggested level is from $35 on up, but hopefully you're pledging because of the type of programming that's done here. I remember doing this program many, many years ago when we were lucky to be able to get some type of, any type of gay and lesbian culture, and we would be talking about every little piece and bit we got. Now we're very lucky that we have a lot more stuff, and we try to bring you some of the stuff behind the scenes or some of the reasons why this stuff is happening. From the opera to the voting booth, there's a lot of things happening in our gay and lesbian community, and remind you that tomorrow, Election Day, the polls are open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. with Denise Parker as one of the 19 candidates running for a city council at-large position. So we're trying to provide you the information and what the entertainment, but we're asking you to become involved. We're asking you to go out and vote. We're asking you to pick up the phone and dial 526-5738. We have Mary Helen out in the lobby, and we do have some people to thank. Mary Helen?
We sure do, Jack, and we'd like to take just a minute to thank all of them who have called up at 526-5738. And if you've been waiting for us to open up the mic out here in Marathon Central, now's your chance to hear your very own telephone all over the 100,000-watt radio station. And the number to call is 526-5738. And I know that's important to most of you. We want to thank... Hey, see? It's important to one person. We want to thank Michael Eckenfels, who's called in to renew his support. Thank you very much, Michael. He appreciates getting voting information, such as you heard tonight about Anise Parker. We'd also like to thank Bob McLaughlin and Christopher Robbins. They called in to renew their support with a family membership.
Wonderful. Yes, we do not require the Texas definition of families do a family membership here.
No, we do not. And they are picking up on a pair of tickets to go on February the 10th to see Fred Small. They're going to be able to pick those tickets up at the door, guys. So they really enjoy Gay and Lesbian Voices, Fresh Air. And they're getting a kick out of 100 Days that's airing in the mornings from 8 to 9 on KPFT.
Mm-hmm.
We'd also like to thank Catherine Horton. She called in from out in Baytown. She is a new subscriber to the station. Said that she met Anise Parker, who we mentioned on KPFT at the ranch, maybe? I don't know. Okay, Anise. We caught you, baby. And we'd also like to thank Sonny Garza. Sonny, if you're listening, would you call us back? Because we need to get a little bit more information from you, if possible. So give us a call back here at the station, and the number again is 526-5738.
So, Mary Helen, tell us about those premiums.
Tell
you. Or have you said enough?
No, well, we still have some more people to thank.
Oh, okay.
But I could tell you about premiums in the meantime, if you would like to hear about some of the wonderful gifts that Jeff and Chuck and Sarah and Michael and Philip could tell you about, if you give us a call here at 526-5738. And some of those are, you know, tickets to the Alley Theater. We have tickets to see The Mystery of Irma Beck. Over at the Alley.
I was thinking about those KPFT premiums.
Oh, those premiums. Well, you know, Jack, the room of premiums just ain't what it used to be.
I guess not.
I'll tell you, they're giving it a shot here at the old station, and so they have come up with a few, you know, ratty old T-shirts and, you know, some kind of cheesy little coffee mugs, and you can get one. Also, there's a watch that probably will work most of the time if you hit it just right on the one side. No, I'm kidding.
It's like our transmitter. You got to hit it on the right part to make it work.
It has the ever so smallest little hamster inside, and you can get one of those. They're really nice.
We kid around a lot, but one of these days we ought to have a tour bus to go out to the transmitter and really show people how the station keeps on the air.
You can't get a bus down that road.
That's true. Although sometimes you can get a boat down there.
Yeah, so if you could really. I mean, it is way out on the northwest
side
of town.
It's way outside the loop.
Yeah, it's out off the northwest side of town. You got to go down a couple of dirt roads to get there. And, you know,
it's a wonder HLMP goes down there.
It's not a place where you could really hang out, you know, unless you really like snakes and, you know, Africanized honeybees and stuff like that. But it does at least serve the purpose of getting the signal out to the Houston area. And we're glad to have what we have. The reason we have what we have is people before you have called in and subscribed to the station. They've called in with pledges of $25 or $50 or $100.
The odds were against the station to be on the air for 25 years. And they're still against this station to continue on the air. And it's up to you to make those odds go away and keep us on. And, I mean, we're very fortunate to be able to do this type of programming. Where else? Who else would have us?
Well, it would be very hard because, you know, if you go on the air and you say, we're going to put on a show called Lesbian and Gay Voices, it's probably doubtful that Coca-Cola or General Motors is going to want to sponsor that program. And as we know, the federal government is getting ready to cut the funding to public radio. And, you know, you're not going to get the Texas legislature or the Houston City Council to approve funds to pay for this kind of radio. It's just not going to happen. So what has to happen is each one of us has to chip in $25, $50, $100, whatever we can afford. We can put it on a credit card. You send a check in the mail, that's just fine. We'll take your name and address. We don't have to thank you by name. If you don't wish for us to do so, we'll be glad to let you remain anonymous. It's very simple, but it's real important. And we don't just go tacking on, you know, 10 or 30 cents or a dollar onto every product that you buy, you know, to go to public radio like you do when you buy a six-pack of Coca-Cola. You got to figure 50 cents of that probably went for the advertising, or probably more than that.
Went in the budget,
went
for
the advertising
the
and the packaging of the product. You know, you're really, that's what you're paying for.
You know, we're also very lucky to have the show on at 6 p.m. A lot of people are driving home, so they're sort of a captive audience in a sense, and they get to listen to us. And it's very convenient for a lot of people to listen to us from 6 to 8 p.m. But we want you to show your appreciation that we get such a good time slot on this radio station by pledging to us at 526 KPFT, 526-5738. It's only because you make a difference are we able to help make a difference.
And people like Becky out in League City, who's called in, who's going to get one of the T-shirts from KPFT, and people like Mary Eggert, who called in and has supported the station before. She's even come down here to be on the station, I believe. Not on this show, but on other ones. We also want to thank a new subscriber. Oh, excuse me, somebody that's a recently renewed subscriber. We'd like to thank
a perpetual one,
Rich Rodkey, who called in last spring, is calling again this year to renew his support. He'd been planning to pledge, but he was waiting on this program to do it. We've only got, another hour or so in the program. We need your support. We're just about halfway to our goal of $1,000 tonight. We were able to go over the goal last Friday night, but we need
your
help
tonight
to do that. We need your help to put us over the goal, and the number you call is 526-5738.
And you know, we might want to tell people, if you don't pledge, we might invite you to one of our programmer meetings.
If you don't pledge,
we're going to invite you to one of the lesbian and gay...
How much do I have to give?
to not go to a meeting? Yes.
Okay. Hey, we have one more person to thank, and then we'll let you get back to what we really do best here, some of the features of the program. We want to thank Cindy Bruning, who called in from out in Pearland. She likes the GNL voices, and we appreciate your support, Cindy. You know, it doesn't matter how much you want to pledge. If it's $25, if it's $100, if it's $500, it's all going to go to support the fine programming you hear on KPFT. It's all real important. And the number to call is 526-KPFT. It's 526-5738 if you're more numerically than alpha numerically inclined. We really want to hear from you, left-handed, right-handed, tall, short, blonde, brunette.
Even if you have
male,
a dial.
Female, straight, gay, lesbian,
or anywhere in between.
Bisexual, trisexual, whatever.
Okay.
Go ahead and do it. It's real easy. And the number, Jack?
The number is 526-5738, 526-KPFT, and we're going to lock Mary Helen back in Campaign Central to, and maybe you can even talk to her if you call it 526-KPFT, 526-5738. We want to thank everybody who has pledged so far and want to remind you, if you haven't pledged, please do call us now. We are going to go back to this interview. It's an interview with Juan Palomo, who's talking about the opera, the Harvey Milk Opera.
We're speaking with Michael Corey and Stuart Wallace, the librettist and composer for the new opera, their world premiere here in Houston on the 21st of January, called Harvey Milk. Stuart, tell us a little bit more about what kind of opera people should expect when they go there. I mean, there's people who turn on the radio on Saturday afternoon and hear all this screaming and yelling in this foreign language, and then there's other operas who are, you know, more like Porgy and Bess, that were, you know, more easy to swallow for people who are not connoisseurs of opera. Where does this fit in?
Well, I think the music will be oddly in an odd way familiar. Not familiar that it's something that they've heard before, but familiar that it grows in the roots of American soil. So growing up here in Texas, it was kind of like growing up in a musical gumbo, and everything was on a level playing field, from classical to rock and roll to blues to mariachi music to conjunto. Everything was available. And so all of that, in a way, informs where I come from musically. As a teenager, I sang in the synagogue as a cantor, and I played rock and roll every Saturday night. So in a way, that combination led me to opera, something with, or at least my version of what an opera should sound like, which is something with very driving, rhythmic, aggressive music, and also the opportunity for long, soaring vocal lines. I mean, there's a very, I think you saw the duet between Scott and Harvey, Harvey's lover and himself in bed. There's a beautiful soaring duet for two men. I'm not sure that that's ever happened on an opera stage before. And underneath it is a kind of moving motion. There's music that's filled with motion and emotion. So I think that what they can expect is something that will be at least culturally familiar, not foreign, something that, along with the issues that are familiar to us, that musically comes from the environment that we all grow up with here in America, this sort of stew of different ideas and different sounds.
I asked Robert, what's his last name?
Orth.
Will sing the part of Harvey Milk, if he had to compare it to, you know, some opera in the old world, or the world of opera. I mean, where would he put it? And he said it probably would be closer to Puccini than to anything else, in that it had so much passion. And Michael, you talked about the passion. In fact, how Stuart kept demanding more passion from you.
This is true. This was a broad life, and they were filled with political battles and things that I thought were, in quotations, important. And Stuart kept saying, well, all this politics is good, but I want the passion. I need something to write music to here. And encouraged me to bring out the passionate side of Harvey, his relationships with his lover, and which transmutes into a passion for justice.
There's a series of chords in the opera that are very aggressive, from when young Harvey Milk is in the park and he sees these men having sex in the bushes, and he's very confused because he's drawn to it and he's also scared by it. And there's a kind of outburst in the orchestra that's very, very driving. Those chords, those sort of frantic sex chords, really become the thing that symbolizes politics by the end of the opera. There's a transformation of sex into politics as the opera progresses.
I never knew that.
Yes. But I want to say one other thing. I can't stand Puccini.
Well, I like Puccini. And what I like most about this opera is that it really is a story. And that, to me, is what opera is. It's the most heightened form of theater, of storytelling. The music brings it just one more level closer. And Stuart and I would say, sort of got into opera through the back door. We didn't anticipate being creators of operas. We were trying to create a very hands-on kind of theater, and opera brought us there. We didn't approach it as classical academics often do, as, well, now it's time to write my opera. It was a natural means of expression for us.
Yeah. Now, part of the passion and the story is more than just about Harvey Milk's homosexuality and his radicalism and his politics. It's also about his Jewishness. I mean, that is a very, very strong core throughout the whole opera, is it not?
Well, we positioned him. You know, Harvey Milk was both a gay person and an ethnic person, and both elements, in fact, played a very strong role in the way that he interacted with the communities in San Francisco. It was, in fact, a way that he built bridges. And it goes back to the earlier question. We said, what makes this guy do this? Why would this kid, this ordinary kid from Long Island, go off and do the things that he did? And we found, in reading first his speeches, then his articles, and then researching his life, that Harvey Milk was profoundly affected by the events of the Holocaust and World War II. And we posited from this that he learned a very important lesson, first for himself as a Jewish man, and later for himself as a gay man, that when you see something that you know is wrong and you are silent in the face of it, the consequences are dire. And so this was the thing, the moral core, the sense of moral outrage that drove him, we think, to achieve the things that he did.
Yeah. Michael, you've talked in the past about a dream that you had that helped to sort of move the opera along when you were at a low point. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, it relates to the point Stuart was just talking about. The opera had been in two acts. It was filled with events, and it didn't have the kind of musical or dramatic flow that we wanted, and we were both very dissatisfied. We had recently been to Germany, and Stuart had visited some of the concentration camps. We had addressed the community there and found it a very highly unfavorable reaction to us. someone who writing an opera about gays and Jews. I went home and I had this dream. It's the only time I ever dreamt of a concept, but I dreamt of a pink triangle, which was, of course, a symbol very meaningful to Harvey Milk. It was the sign branded on 300,000 gay men and women from the Berlin gay rights movement that perished in the concentration camps. And then slowly behind this pink triangle, I dreamt of another triangle, a yellow triangle, and they came together and formed a six-pointed star. And when I woke up, I said, this is the metaphor for Harvey Milk, a man with a foot in two camps whose star is a pair of triangles, one pink, one yellow. I told Stuart, and he was very excited, and he told me that actually this thing had existed in the concentration camps. The Nazis had given the Jews yellow triangles and the gays pink triangles, yellow stars and the gays pink triangles. They also gave different color-coded signs for the political prisoners, the gypsies, the communists, the dissidents, and they had a graph where they mixed and matched these things, and a gay Jew was in fact made to wear a pink and yellow triangle. And then I knew that we had hit upon a concept for our understanding of Harvey Milk.
What would you say to, say, conservative Jewish person who goes to the opera and sees, you know, sort of combining both elements of Harvey Milk, his homosexuality and Jewishness, and say, you know, how dare you equate one with the other?
Well, we're not equating one with the other. I think that's a mistake to say that. What we are saying is that Harvey Milk was a person who has two different heritages. And from those, I think the mistake is to say, oh, you're comparing sufferings and all that, and it dilutes both sufferings. It's not about that at all. It's about who is Harvey Milk. He was born in a Jewish family, and he was a gay man. What is the combination of those elements? What happens when those elements are brought together in this one person? And how does that make him run? And we kept asking, what makes Harvey Milk run? What makes him do these things?
His contradiction was that he could and did stand up for himself as a Jew. And there was a documented fight that he had with a German businessman that's in the opera. But he could not stand up for himself as a gay man in the era of the closet. And when he learned the same sort of standing up, the same sort of activist stand that he uses as a Jew is necessary to be a whole person as a gay man, then he was able to put these two together.
I mean, then he
so
becomes
we're not,
the Harvey Milk we
we're
know,
not
really.
Equating. We're showing how morality is born and moves on and empowers an individual and then great groups of people.
I mean, the thing that was inspiring for both of us, I think, about Harvey Milk was that he had a very naive belief, which was that he, as a single person, if he faced the world with the courage of his convictions and faced it boldly, that he could change the world. And this was in fact, in the light of the 80s and the political climate in the United States, something that was incredibly moving for both of us and inspiring for us. And that's what we wanted the opera to say to people, in a way, that you can, if you engage yourself, make a difference in the world. And it's important to do that.
Could either of you just briefly sort of capitalize what the opera entails, or the three separate acts, and so that the listeners can get an idea of what we're talking about here?
Well, we decided that there was no way to tell the story of Harvey Milk without understanding the obstacles and walls that he confronted. And it was a piece that would span a great many decades in American history. And in essence, it's the story of the birth and struggle of the rights movement to emerge, as encapsulated in the experience of this one man, Harvey Milk. The first act, it's divided into three, is called The Closet, which covers the years of his coming out, his living in the closet as a closeted Wall Street broker, until finally his politicization in the wake of the Stonewall Uprising, where he begins his romance with activism. The second act is called The Castro, where he has given up his Wall Street job, his comforts, to open a shabby camera store on Castro Street, which was then the gay ghetto, emerging in the early 70s. And he becomes very important in the register to vote movement, in the come out movement, and with the votes that he registers, he does eventually overcome defeat to win election as an openly gay elected supervisor. And the second act concludes with a massive and ebullient pride parade that spills into the audience. The third act is where Harvey, fearing that he doesn't have that long to live, becomes very driven. It's called City Hall, and he has an agenda to pass. He wants to get his gay rights ordinance through before an assassination that he has predictions of. And eventually he is assassinated by Dan White, who is a fellow worker, a fellow elected official on the Board of Supervisors, along with Dianne Feinstein, who was at that time another elected supervisor. And Dan White assassinates both George Moscone and Harvey Milk, and San Francisco remembers them in a very moving elegy at the end that concludes the opera, which Stuart has based on the Hebrew prayer of remembrance, the Kaddish.
I mean, this is something else that addresses your question about, you know, well, people, we don't want to see these things. We don't want to see them. The importance for Harvey Milk and for us of remembering the past so that you can build on it, so that you know where you come from, is very, very much a part of this opera. And in fact, people who don't want to see their past are in trouble for the future. And if people are not looking, you know, you can't always sit there and hope that people will accept you because you're more like them. I mean, I think the lesson of Harvey Milk is that you have to be who you are, and people have to get used to it or adjust to it.
Both of you live in New York, so you're gonna leave here after January and not have to face any of the consequences of what you have produced. But this is what the rest of us here have to put up with. And this is a letter I received after I wrote a column about Harvey Milk, and it says, "While we the people remain in the face of a staggering array of dark forces, you have asked us to stray to the fringe and try to appreciate some show about homosexuals and lesbians. You must be proud to be able to say favorable things about the liberal fringe aberrations in your 45 square inches. It is indeed an advertisement for this bit of, quote, art, unquote, because your space is on the op-ed page." Have you all discussed about what the reaction might be from the more conservative?
Well, we have. You know, Harvey Milk got hate letters every single week of his life. And in fact, they joked about it in the office, and they had a hate mail of the week contest. And they hung them all up
on
the wall.
They
were frightened, and that was a way of dealing with our fear. I don't think that we're going to leave the consequences of what we've done behind in Houston. I think that we have grown. during the writing of this piece, and we'll carry what it has given us with us everywhere. There are always letters like that. There will always be letters like that.
All the more reason to do this.
The importance of this piece is remembering our history. And I don't consider this gay history. I consider this part of American history. It's a part of American history that is not taught in the schools and is not taught by families. But what we have learned in going back over the eons, the ages of gay history, is that the same battles we're fighting today were fought many times before. The same states that are...
starting again.
That are starting the anti-gay ordinances were the same people who did it before. A whole movement of gays and lesbians was wiped out in Nazi Germany in 1945. You know, today many gays themselves don't remember Harvey Milk, or they remember him only through the knowledge of his death and the injustice of the sentence given to Dan White. They don't remember the importance of his life.
You know, when I was on the Castro, I was visiting the San Francisco Opera to discuss this opera, and I went to the Castro and I went around walking around the streets and I said, where was Castro Camera? Nobody knew.
Yeah.
So that's why the opera, the address...
I think they have finally gotten a plaque up there.
Yeah, it's a plaque, but at the opera, the address of the Camera store is there.
But to go back to this point of remembrance, Harvey Milk lived in the age before AIDS, which marshaled a great activist force in America and the world. And of course, it has commanded all our attention. But there was activism before this era, and it's important for us to know that we keep running into the same brick walls again and again. And I feel that remembrance is a prelude, a necessary prelude to activism. You have to know your history.
You guys are the artists, you're the creators, yet without one person at least, you wouldn't be able to do what you're doing, and that person is David Gockley. I mean,
he's an amazing...
Tell us, this is a straight man in conservative Houston with a conservative board, I assume. And yet he's constantly, this is not the first controversial opera he did. Where's Dick with you guys?
I don't think David seeks controversy. I think he seeks a good story. Mm-hmm. And he saw in this a story that was about America. And he saw an opportunity for great music that Stewart could write. And I think that is always his primary concern. He was also very moved
by the documentary.
By the documentary about Harvey Milk's life and the fact that Milk managed to cross barriers. Milk appealed to lesbians in a time of feminist separatism. He appealed to the Teamsters. He appealed to Chinese Americans and Latinos and African Americans and children and senior citizens. And this moved David very much. And he felt that Harvey Milk's struggle stood for more than just the struggle of gay rights. It stood for the struggle of...
against the forces of conservatism. The things that you're talking about, in fact. And I think that the opera company has distinguished itself internationally by the fact that David has been willing to help create new works that are engaged in the contemporary world and not just to put up pretty museum pieces.
I asked David why something like this would originate in a place like Houston and not New York, and he said nothing new comes out of New York anymore. Do y'all agree with that, too?
Yeah, most of it comes out of Houston. I think that sometimes people don't quite realize the international prominence that the Houston Grand Opera has for creating new American operas.
Frequently the creators are in New York, but they go all over the place, and it's true. It's harder and harder to do anything new in New York.
And I think the reason why it's happening in Houston is because David is in Houston, and because David has found an audience that supports his vision.
He said that one of his biggest fears for this opera was that it would be seen as a gimmick piece and not as a serious work.
Or a gay equivalency piece, yes.
All right. What is your biggest fear, aside from a flop and the eyes of
I wouldn't be happy if it were pigeonholed because of its world. I feel that every opera has to create a very specific world. You know, Porgy and Bess is an opera that takes place in this small, small hamlet on Catfish Row, and every character is very precisely drawn, and it's specific to that piece on that stage at that time. And yet it's done all over the world and has great universality. And I think it's because it's so specific. And in the same way, Harvey Milk takes this world of the gay political world struggling to emerge in the 70s, and we're very specific with it. And I hope, once again, that that will give us a universality.
I also hope that we, you know, we change the way that people look at the world. I mean, we've sketched Dan White in a very particular way. Dan White was a tricky problem, because here's a man who we could have very easily caricatured, or we could have very easily just poked fun at. But I think that the ideas and things that he expresses and that he embodied were things that many people in America feel. So the job for us was to start Dan White from a rather sympathetic place for those people in the audience who will feel that way, so that by following Dan White, we can see what happens when you take those ideas to their extreme and the dangers of that kind of thought. So I think really, I mean, I'm not afraid it's a gimmick piece, because it's not. And the drama is incredibly strong. And really, I think what we want to do with all of our works, but I think particularly this one, is make people's lives different by the time they leave the theater.
I know that both of you are working separately with other composers, librettists on another project. Are you all going to come back together again? Is that a possibility?
We certainly hope so. Yeah. I think that we've learned a lot with Harvey Milk, and that's...
I think we've learned a lot from each other in 10 years.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Michael and I have really gone to school together, in a way, and we've challenged each other. It's been an incredible collaboration.
Yeah, it's true. My work has gotten, I feel, so much better having worked with Stewart.
Yeah.
But we did learn in our first three operas, where we really tried to fight City Hall. We really wrote anti-opera operas. We went against precedent to try and find our own vision. Oddly enough, in Harvey Milk, we went back to the classical format, though not traditional at all, the way we handle it, of the three-act opera, with the figure who is both mythic and tragic. And it really made the music leap off the page. And I think that when we do another opera, we're going to make sure that we find a subject that turns us on.
Well, I want to thank you again for being here. I want to say that, I've sat in on a couple of rehearsals, and I have been terribly moved and terribly impressed. I mean, I was sort of moved to tears in one scene where, I mean, I guess I was supposed to, there was Harvey Milk struggling with, you know, his handcuffs and stuff, but there was this other scene of the Stonewall Riot, and I guess I should have been moved by Harvey Milk, but it was what was going on and with the riot, you know, as a gay man, which really sort of brought tears to my eyes, you know, and sort of put some pride in my heart. I think it's going to be a very powerful opera. As I said, I'm not an opera critic, so I can't tell, but I would hope that a lot of people have an opportunity to go see it. And
I hope the word opera doesn't scare them off.
I mean, we want people who don't come to the opera to come.
Okay.
I would like everybody, straight, gay, to come, and I would like them to come and take over the theater.
Right. Well, I hope so, too. This has been Juan Palomo with Michael Khoury, librettist for Harvey Milk, and Stuart Wallace, the composer. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Juan Palomo, for that excellent interview. I know most of our listeners to Lesbian and Gay Voices probably have just been glued to the radio listening to that.